Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. This week we present Stephen Gardner of Political Research Associates, who discusses the right-wing militia plot to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer and the wider threat posed by armed white supremacist groups during the November 3rd election. Tom Colina, Director of Policy with the Plowshares Fund, who examines the extreme risk of giving U.S. presidents unilateral unchecked power to launch a nuclear war. And Norman Clement, an indigenous activist, who talks about local and national efforts to honor indigenous people and the ongoing struggle for treaty rights to overcome discrimination and poverty. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A week after discredited parliamentary elections, Kyrgyzstan's embattled pro-Russian president, Sooronbay Jeenbekov, declared a state of emergency after demonstrators took to the streets of the capital, Bishkek, and stormed government buildings, demanding a new vote and his resignation. More than 1,200 people have been injured, and one person has been killed in street clashes since protests erupted. Police have reportedly used water cannons, stun grenades, and tear gas to disperse protesters. On October 10th, Kyrgyzstan's parliament named nationalist politician Zaidar Zaparov as new prime minister. That same day, security forces detained former president Almazbek Atambayev, who had been freed by supporters days earlier in protests in the capital. The landlocked country, which borders China, was part of the Soviet Union until independence in 1991. It has a reputation for holding semi-free and fair elections, in contrast with some of its neighbors, but uprisings in 2005 and 2010 swept previous presidents from power. Jared Kushner's family-owned business, Kushner Companies, won $786 million in loans to purchase hundreds of apartments in Maryland and Virginia from government-backed lending agency Freddie Mac in 2019. Disclosure of the mortgage loans prompted Democratic Senators Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts and Tom Carper of Delaware to ask if the family real estate firm, formerly led by the president's son-in-law and top advisor, had received special treatment. Freddie Mac approved the loans after its parent agency came under the leadership of Trump appointee Mark Calabria, Vice President Mike Pence's former chief economist. The loan ranked among Freddie Mac's largest ever. Kushner's lawyer said Jared was no longer involved in decision-making at the company, but does continue to receive millions of dollars from the family business, including income from some properties purchased with the Freddie Mac-backed loans. U.S. taxpayers could be responsible for paying back much of the nearly $850 million in Freddie Mac financing if Kushner Companies defaults and its properties drop significantly in value. During the last real estate crash, taxpayers had to bail out the agency and its larger sibling, Fannie Mae, to the tune of $190 billion as the agencies plunged into the government equivalent of bankruptcy. Ohio in recent months had drifted off the list of Midwestern battleground states. President Donald Trump had defeated Hillary Clinton by 8 percentage points in 2016 and won over blue-collar workers, many of whom had been plagued by layoffs. But the American Prospect reports that 2020 in Ohio is a different story, with a sinking economy, COVID-19, and the registration of new voters that is giving Ohio Democrats hope that they can carry the state. While the percentage of white working-class voters is declining, seniors and women voters are angry about Trump's epic failure to manage the federal response to the coronavirus pandemic that has killed more than 212,000 Americans. Meanwhile, 912,000 new Ohio voters have registered since 2016, with an estimated 250,000 young people voting for the first time, most likely favoring Democrats. One in five workers in Ohio have applied for unemployment since April, which helps explain why Trump's approval rating in the state has dropped by 15% since his election and currently stands at 46%. as cracks have begun to appear in the state's Republican Party and among evangelical Christians, former Vice President Joe Biden maintains a slight lead in state polls and is investing more funds in political advertising. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As tensions ratcheted up amid a bitterly fought U.S. presidential election campaign, the FBI announced the arrest of 13 men on charges of conspiring to kidnap Michigan's Governor Gretchen Whitmer, attack the state legislature, and threaten law enforcement. The militants arrested also reportedly had been involved in a similar plot to kidnap Democratic Virginia Governor Ralph Northam. Seven of those arrested were associated with an anti-government militia group called the Wolverine Watchmen, and two of those charged in the alleged domestic terrorism plot are former Marines. At a news conference following the arrests, Governor Whitmer accused President Trump of fomenting political extremism, citing his comments during last week's U.S. presidential debate against Joe Biden, in which Trump declined to condemn white supremacists. Before an anti-pandemic lockdown protest against Whitmer in April, Trump had tweeted a provocative message to his followers that read, "Liberate Michigan." Your reporter spoke with Stephen Gardner, assistant research director with Political Research Associates, who discusses the militia plot to kidnap Governor Whitmer and the wider threat posed by armed white supremacist groups and vigilantes who've been embraced by President Trump and who he's asked to monitor the polls in the November 3rd election.
The important thing, I think, is to put it into context. There has been months and months, even before the uptick, I mean, the vast uptick in protests for racial justice following the murder of George Floyd, that has led to its own backlash from the far right and a large number of incidents trying to counter or intimidate that movement for racial justice. So an incident like this is part of an ongoing development of far-right politics in public. I mean, it started most recently, a new cycle of it started with the COVID lockdown and protests in many states, including, of course, in Michigan, that were essentially saying the measures put into place to defend public health and take care of people were somehow authoritarian, tyrannical, that they were undermining the basic rights of people because they were being asked to wear a mask or close their business while we got a deadly virus under control. So this particular act, it's within a range of possibilities. I mean, we've already seen shootings. We've seen dozens, perhaps over 100 vehicular assaults on protesters. Now, the difference here is that a public official is being targeted. The people who were targeting it come from not sort of unaffiliated armed mobs or people who show up a couple of days after a call goes out on Facebook, as they did, say, in Kenosha. But they were actively planning an attack on a sitting governor, basically the definition of insurrection. So the idea that there was no crime here is absurd, even though it was a foiled plot.
Assess for us the threat of violence on Election Day by militia, white supremacist groups, and vigilantes on the day of the election as well as the days that follow, given the fact that Trump has said there is no way he could lose this election unless it's rigged, sending a signal out to his supporters that there is evil to be opposed if he should lose that election.
I can do an assessment. The assessment, of course, is not a prediction. And I think it's important to understand that the threats that are coming down the line that we're already seeing from the far right about showing up at polling places or rallying in cities or exaggerated claims about, say, anarchist violence in the cities are already absent clear talk and courageous talk from political leadership at state and local levels, liable to depress voter turnout. People may be intimidated to go to the polls. They may be late to get in their absentee or mail-in ballot or from a place where those are more difficult to use. They may feel that all of this contentiousness means that the electoral system that they maybe didn't believe in so much to begin with is completely out of control, and they don't want to waste their time just to have their vote nullified by, say, a Secretary of State or local election officials sympathetic to the current administration. So there are a lot of variables in play there. There is certainly the possibility of violence on or after Election Day. I think it's more likely that what we will see is three things. One, there will be threats of large-scale protests from the right turning out to, quote-unquote, protect the process. This is a common claim amongst the militia and paramilitary groups that they're there to protect something, a federal courthouse, private property, what have you. Two, you might have small-scale violent instigators who could be the particularly zealous pro-Trump factions who might take it upon themselves to create confrontation with protesters or election watchers who they see as the opposition. And third, by individuals who might even be anti-regime, but also attempting to start a, as in the Boogaloo movement, many parts of the Boogaloo movement to start a wider conflagration because they see the country as irredeemable and therefore chaos and civil war are the only answers. None of the most extreme things have to happen in order to be a big blow to people's trust in what, after 4 years of the Trump administration, are already shaky levels of trust in democratic institutions. So what I would say is people should be prepared. We should be organizing, and many people I know are, to get that early voting done, early in-person voting or absentee voting or mail-in voting or drop-off voting done as soon as we can, and then be prepared for a long drawn-out process in which both the right and the forces that are pro-democracy are going to be out on the streets. This is going to be a situation in the United States we haven't seen since the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, most likely, unless the only thing that might hinder that would be a landslide early victory for Vice President Biden.
That was Stephen Gardner, Assistant Research Director with Political Research Associates. Learn more about the extremist groups aligned with Donald Trump and the threat they pose to the November 3rd election by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. When President Trump checked into Walter Reed Military Medical Center on October 2nd, after being diagnosed with a coronavirus, like all presidents, he was followed by a military aide that carries the football, the secure briefcase with the key codes and protocols necessary for him to order the U.S. military to launch up to 1,000 nuclear weapons, more than enough to destroy the world. Although Mr. Trump had suffered with low blood oxygen levels and was taking the drug dexamethasone, a corticosteroid which can cause mood swings and frank psychotic manifestations, the president never transferred his powers to the vice president as permitted under the 25th Amendment. During his time in the hospital and immediately after, Mr. Trump exhibited behavior that some observers labeled as roid rage, aggression and anger some people experience when taking steroid medications. Your reporter spoke with Tom Colina, Director of Policy at the Plowshares Fund, who talks about the extreme risk of giving U.S. presidents unchecked unilateral power to launch a nuclear war, as discussed in his recent article titled, Trump's COVID Infection Shows Why It's Time to Retire the Nuclear Football.
It would have been nice to see President Trump transfer authority when he was at Walter Reed Hospital, because not only did his blood oxygen level go down, according to his doctor, which affects judgment, but he's on heavy, heavy steroids. The most concerning one is dexamethasone, which can cause mood swings and psychotic disorders. And, you know, so if a president is undergoing those kind of treatments, that kind of situation, their decision-making is impaired. And they should transfer that authority, and that would have been the right thing to do in this situation. But unfortunately, the president did not do that. I mean, there are concerns about Trump and his judgment and his erratic, impulsive nature, his lack of attention to detail, his reluctance to speak with experts or take expert advice. So there are concerns about his judgments about nuclear policy separate from the recent COVID situation, right? And I think this is true about Trump, but it's also true about presidents the further you get away from the Cold War, where I think presidents were much more up to the level of details and expertise necessary to be the sole decider on nuclear weapons. When they really thought it might be a possibility that the weapons would be used, they would study this much more closely. And I think the further we've gotten away from the Cold War, presidents just don't take this possibility all that seriously. So they don't study up for it. They don't prepare for it.
Is there any pressure that can be brought to bear on a president to relinquish that authority when they're in the midst of a medical or mental health crisis?
You know, the idea is to deal with it before you get there, right? And there was nothing unpredictable. I mean, President Trump knew he was going to the hospital. He knew that the impacts of COVID, he knew that presumably his doctors knew that he would be taking these steroids. So it was predictable that he would be undergoing decision-making issues. And so therefore, before you get to that point, right, you want to deal with these issues. But there's a broader point here, which is that it, in my view and in Secretary Perry's view, who co-authored the book with me, we really feel strongly that no president should have the unilateral authority to end the world, because presidents don't know when to give up that authority. I mean, it's a powerful thing, right? It's kind of like a drug in and of itself. Presidents are very reluctant to give it up. You know, if you go back through history, President Nixon was drinking heavily at the end of his administration before the impeachment hearings, and was drunk in office and didn't give up the authority. And there are a number of stories where presidents should have given up that authority and did not. And even a healthy president, I mean, you have to imagine what you've got is we're putting one person in control essentially of civilization and the future of life on Earth. And they're a fallible human, just like the rest of us. And so we have to ask ourselves the question, why are we putting one fallible human in charge of the fate of the world? And particularly in the case of Donald Trump, why are we putting one man on mood-altering medications as the only thing that stands between us and nuclear war? It just doesn't make sense.
Tom, I did want to ask you about the real goal of this article here. In challenging the president's unilateral power to launch a nuclear war, or nuclear retaliation in the case of an attack on the United States, what is the blueprint that you're thinking about here? What are the alternatives to a president having his and only his or her finger on the button?
Right. Great question. So three parts to this solution. One is that the president should give up the sole authority and share that authority with Congress. To me, that's a much more democratic way to do it. And the current system that we have is frankly undemocratic, because it's Congress that under the Constitution is supposed to declare war. Yet we have the president has the ability to launch nuclear weapons first out of the blue without consulting Congress at all, which to me is the ultimate declaration of war. So we need to make this process more democratic, bring it back in line with the Constitution. So the president should have to consult with and get the approval of Congress before using nuclear weapons first. You could also just have a complete no first use ban. In other words, the United States could never use nuclear weapons first in any situation. That would also take care of the blundering into nuclear war under a false alarm danger. And then third, we would like to retire the weapons that are most vulnerable to an attack and create this false alarm danger. That is the land-based ballistic missiles. We can retire them. We'd be safer without them, and we'd certainly be a lot better off financially, because the Air Force is just starting a process to rebuild the entire arsenal of these weapons to the tune of about $260 billion over the next few decades. So we think it would be much smarter to not do that, to retire these weapons and take that money and spend it on things where we really have challenges, like addressing COVID-19, climate change, racial injustice, you know, the things that are really on the public's mind right now and that we need to solve, and not spend on these weapons that actually will be making us less safe.
That was Tom Colina, director of policy at the Plowshares Fund, and co-author with former Secretary of Defense William Perry of The Button, The New Nuclear Arms Race and Presidential Power, From Truman to Trump. Find a link to Tom's recent article on Trump and the nuclear football and related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Indigenous communities and their allies around the country had targeted statues of Christopher Columbus as representative of a vicious colonialism without much success until protests erupted after the police killing of George Floyd in May. Racial justice activists protested not only against statues representing defenders of white supremacy and support for slavery, but also targeted Columbus and what he stood for. News reports from local sources around the country found that at least 22 statues of Columbus have been destroyed or removed since May. In New Haven, Connecticut, a statue of Columbus in a historically Italian neighborhood, a few blocks from the city's downtown green, was removed on June 24th after various stakeholders agreed it no longer belonged there. A week later, the city's Board of Education voted to rename the Columbus Family Academy, which is a public school in an overwhelmingly Latino neighborhood. The new name is still to be determined after discussions that included members of the community. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Norman Clement, an Indigenous activist and supporter of Black Lives Matter, who convened a commemoration on October 12th for Indigenous Peoples Day that's replaced Columbus Day. Here he discusses his motivation for holding these annual events, the progress he's seen, and the struggles still unfolding across the U.S.
It's something I've done every year. Usually, you know, it was fighting either against the statue or the Columbus School. In other years, it was more of a demonstration and a resistance. I would finally have some recognition. I went to the Key Bank in Fairhaven, and they had a flyer on the window on the door that said, we will be closed for Indigenous Peoples Day. And I was like, that's like the first time I've seen that recognition like that from a major corporation or company, you know. So it really struck me as, hey, this really is happening. I was struggling with how I was feeling about it, you know. And I was really happy, but then I was like, you know, why isn't this something that happens everywhere, you know? You know, and that's what I want to try and do, people that, you know, to have them recognize who they are, you know. Like, I work with the immigrant community. I try to get people to recognize that, you know, just because they speak Spanish doesn't mean that that's who they are. You know, they need to look into their indigenous side and discover that.
Norman Clement, what do you think are the top two or three issues that Indigenous people are fighting for that you want people to stand behind you on?
One of the biggest issues in which would solve many, many problems among Indigenous people is to have our treaties recognized. You know, 3,800 treaties that were signed with the U.S. government as us being sovereign nations. And every single one of them was broken by the U.S. government. They're not recognized. Their reservations and the little scraps of earth that they put us on are still being encroached upon. You know, whenever they find oil or uranium or gold or whatever they're seeking. You know.
What would it mean to recognize the treaties? Would that mean the government giving land back? Or if white people were settled there, would they have to give up their homes? What exactly would it mean?
And we're not necessarily looking for people to give up their homes. You know, but I think something just happened in Oklahoma, right, where half of Oklahoma was recognized as indigenous land. I believe it was over a lawsuit where an indigenous man was arrested and he wanted to be tried in indigenous courts. And like with this whole issue around murdered and missing women, there's a law that's still in effect. People have been fighting against it for a while. We have, you know, like a lot of reservations have their own police departments. They have their own courts. But if a white man murders an indigenous woman or harms an indigenous woman or any person, for that matter, he cannot be tried in indigenous court. He goes to a white court and gets tried by white people, the U.S. justice system. Things like that. We want recognition for that. And, of course, we want some reparations, you know. This whole country built on our lands. There would be no wealth in the United States if it wasn't for our lands. So why shouldn't we live economically secure? And that doesn't happen. A lot of reservations have 60, 70, 80% unemployment, mass suicide, there's drug addictions, we don't get services, all these things that happened because of colonialism.
Would that take the form of payments from the government to improve health and education and other things?
Well, not individually payments, but resources to develop our own industries. Stop stripping the oil and the uranium out of our lands and let us make that money, provide jobs for our people. You know, you go out west, there's all these man camps, and that's the main reason why there's murdered and missing indigenous women is these man camps. You know, most of the people that are working there are white, even though they're on indigenous lands. They don't get the benefit.
I know there's a lot of different opinions in Indian country, but I wonder if you have any sense of whether there'd be as much mining on indigenous lands if the people controlled their economy.
Probably not. The benefits of infusing money into the economy is also developing new ideas. I know, like after Standing Rock, there's a lot of solar energy companies springing up on indigenous lands, providing solar power, wind power. You know, there's a lot of different things being talked about, but there's no money to develop these things.
That was Norman Clement, an indigenous activist from New Haven, Connecticut. Learn more about the campaign to expose the genocidal history of Christopher Columbus and indigenous rights struggles today by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WXOJ in Florence, Massachusetts, WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, KODX in Seattle, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.